I do believe that there is a significant risk that Israel will restart the war with Iran. And I suspect that that would happen sometime before the end of December. And let me explain why. The Israelis had three key objectives with their attack on Iran back in June. The first one was successful, the other two were not. The first one was to finally get the United States into a shooting war with the Iranians. This is something that the Israelis had tried for more than 25 plus years, particularly Benjamin Netanyahu. They had been failing to do so with all previous presidents, including Trump himself during his first term. But this time around, they succeeded for a variety of reasons, but the success was nevertheless limited because the Israeli desire had been to make sure that the US would be a full partner in this war and take out a significant amount of Iran's military capability, not just its nuclear infrastructure. But having started this war and having degraded Iran's air defense systems and made it more vulnerable, and we saw massive Mossad operations inside the country, the Israelis calculate that they cannot afford to allow Iran enough time to rebuild all of those things.
Hey everybody, this is Andy here. I usually don't give an intro, but I want to do this out of a lot of respect for my guest here. Trita Parsi is on with me today. He is the executive VP of the Quincy Institute and an award-winning author of Washingtonian Magazine has named him one of the most influential voices on foreign policy. Noam Chomsky calls him one of the most distinguished scholars on Iran. I got that from your Substack, Trita. To all my viewers and listeners, I am a supporter of Trita on his Substack. Trita, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank
How
you
are
so
you?
much for having me. Thank
You're
you.
You're very welcome. Trita, let's just jump deep dive into it here. So we have all of this escalation. It's a continual escalation going on in the Middle East, specifically with Israel and its neighbors and Iran. Why is this escalation going on, number one? And number two, is war inevitable? And I don't mean that as a gotcha question, but it seems like that's the road that we're going to be going on sooner than later. In fact, I think sooner. Why is that the case? What's the reasons behind this?
Thank you so much again for having me. I don't think war is inevitable. There's always an option of being able to avoid it. Unfortunately, we have seen that decision makers in the region and beyond have oftentimes seen war or some degree of kinetic action to be in their interest, and as a result, not only have moved in that direction, but also have stacked the cards in order to make it as likely as possible. Not inevitable, but as likely as possible. You're quite right. I do believe that there is a significant risk that Israel will restart the war with Iran. And I suspect that that would happen sometime before the end of December. And let me explain why. The Israelis had three key objectives with their attack on Iran back in June. The first one was successful, the other two were not. The first one was to finally get the United States into a shooting war with the Iranians. This is something that the Israelis had tried for more than 25 plus years, particularly Benjamin Netanyahu. They had been failing to do so with all previous presidents, including Trump himself during his first term. But this time around, they succeeded for a variety of reasons, but the success was nevertheless limited because the Israeli desire had been to make sure that the US would be a full partner in this war and take out a significant amount of Iran's military capability, not just its nuclear infrastructure, because the US, of course, comes in with way more firepower than the Israelis have. But Trump only did a one-off. He was not interested in a longer war. He seems to be very inclined to always avoid something that he cannot control. A quick military action he seems to be quite inclined to use, but not anything that drags on. Nevertheless, I would put it in the success category for the Israelis, given how long they had sought to get this reality and only achieved it here. The two other objectives were not successful. The second one of those was to make sure that they would decapitate the Iranian regime, the entire Iranian state system. And they had some significant successes in the 21st 4 hours of that war. They assassinated a large number of Iran's top military officials, nuclear officials, incidentally also their families, because they killed them in their apartments when they were asleep. But within 18 hours, the Iranians had replaced all of them and started shooting missiles against Israel. And a lot of those missiles actually were very, very effective. And I think that Israelis were taken aback by the resilience of the Iranian system. And I think they were also surprised by the reaction of the Iranian people because you saw a massive wave of nationalism. And I think many were surprised by it. I was surprised by the degree of it because at the end of the day, the Iranian government is profoundly unpopular. I think, in fact, the Iranian government itself was surprised by the degree of nationalism that swept the country. So that objective clearly was a failure. In fact, it may have been counterproductive, at least in the short term, because I think, at least currently, the distance between society and government in Iran is actually lesser than what it was prior to the attack. Whether that is a sustainable situation or just a temporary phenomenon remains to be seen. The third objective is the most important one and the reason why the Israelis are likely to attack again. And that is that from the Israeli standpoint, they want to reduce Iran into another Lebanon, another Syria, a country that Israel can attack at will with impunity and, most importantly, without American involvement. Currently, clearly, Israel does not have that capability. The US has to be deeply involved in the war. In fact, the United States consumed 25% of all of its THAAD interceptors during that 12-day war in a region that three administrations in a row have said is not even vital to US interest. We consumed a quarter of our THAAD interceptors. Those are the best anti-air defense system that exists in the world, and we do need it in many different places. Middle East is frankly not one of them. And so that attack, I don't think the Israelis had the expectation that they would be able to reduce Iran into the next Syria within, with one attack alone. I do think, however, that they thought that they were going to be able to go further than what they did. And part of the reason why they didn't succeed in going further is because of the effectiveness of the Iranian counterattacks with its missiles. The Iranian missiles penetrated all layers of Israel's air defense system, the Arrows 1, 2, and 3, the Patriot, Iron Dome, David Sling, and of course the THAAD as well. Of course, a large number of them were shot down. But over the course of the war, we saw how a smaller number of Iranian missiles actually penetrated the Israeli defense systems at a higher rate because the Iranians started to learn better exactly how to shoot it, when to shoot it, how to combine it with cyber attacks to take out some of those missiles, air defense system for just a second or two. But having started this war and having degraded Iran's air defense systems and made it more vulnerable, and we saw massive Mossad operations inside a country, the Israelis calculate that they cannot afford to allow Iran enough time to rebuild all of those things. Because if the Iranians rebuild their air defense systems, perhaps even if they have enough time to buy real proper ones from the Chinese or others, if they manage to sweep away a large part of the Mossad presence in the country, then the next attack will be much, much more difficult for the Israelis. So they need to attack from their calculation, from their standpoint, before Iran manages to do that. So that's one clock. The other clock that is ticking, of course, is the American political clock. And this is why I put this at the end of December. Once the US enters the midterm election season, it is not prohibitive, but it will make things much, much more complicated for the Israelis. It will make Trump much more hesitant about green lighting such an attack for the Israelis. And then, of course, you have the clock of Israel's own military readiness, et cetera. And I don't have much insight into that. But if we set that aside for a second, at least the desire, the need to attack again before December, I think is clear. Whether they are ready to do so remains, of course, to be seen. One last point of this. Because of the fact that the Iranians understand this, they understand that the desire of the goal of the Israelis is to reduce them to the next Syria or Lebanon. It means that the Iranians will do everything they can, most likely, in the early phase of the next war to inflict as much damage on Israel as possible in order to dispel any notion that Iran can be turned into the next Syria or Lebanon, which then would mean that we will have much higher casualty rate attacks and events in Israel, most likely in the early phases of the war. That, I think, also then dramatically increases the risk of the US getting dragged into the war. And I think from the standpoint of most Americans, the desire is to not be involved in any more wars in the region, particularly not one that is actually started not by the United States itself with its own calculation, but it is started by the Israelis, and the US has to enter it because of the failure of the Israelis.
Yeah. Okay. So you said a lot there, and I want to work it out a little bit. My biggest question in all of this is, what does the US get out of it? I don't see the benefit. And again, I just for the record, I am pretty much anti-war. I'm against this war, and I'm against almost all wars. And I see but I just don't understand. Like, you can see some benefit out of some wars, if you would, I guess, strategically or economically. I just don't see any benefit out of this. What is the benefit to the
We
U.S.? Go ahead.
not nothing. There is
Right?
nothing.
Then why are
There's
we doing
absolutely
it?
nothing.
Is it just incredible pressure from Israel or what?
There is a tremendous pressure from Israel, but there's also this other thing, which is that the establishment foreign policy and grand strategy is one in which, and this has been ongoing for decades now, is one in which we believe that we have to dominate almost every region of the world militarily. We have to be the global hegemon. That's why we have 750 bases around the world. The Chinese have two. The French and the Russians have 11 each. Those are the countries that have the largest number of foreign bases after the United States. And we have about 750. So you can just see how massive that gap is. And then you can better understand why, if you travel to Asia, you see why their infrastructure is so amazing and why ours is so decaying. We do not get anything out of it, but we are stuck in a grand strategy that believes that we have to be everywhere all the time. And if we do dominate every region around the world militarily all the time, we will be at war somewhere all the time. And that is the history of the United States for the last four decades. Now, what's fascinating is that the one region in which there is an increasing consensus on both sides that we, or and particularly amongst the grassroots, the voters on the left and the right, is that the Middle East really does not matter to the United States in the same way that it arguably did 40 years ago. And that we do need to get out. We still have 50,000 troops in the region. We still have about 19 bases in the region. And the combination of inertia, the combination of a lot of hawks in Washington who still believe that we have to be there and we have to sell more weapons, and pressure from Israel is part of the reason why we're there. And as long as we are there, we will be on the verge of war because of all of these partner countries that are pressuring us in that direction. But to your question, what do we get out of it? Nothing.
Okay, so what does really, and you mentioned that Israel wants to turn Iran into the next Lebanon or Syria, but that still begs the question, what does Israel get out of it? And I mean that because their economy is falling apart. They've lost the narrative, if you would, especially with the American general public, I would argue. It's hard to me, even for me, to see what their benefit is to that, if you could answer that. And then the second thing is also confuses me. Trump was in Saudi, I want to say, in June, and he got a hero's welcome. What do the Middle Eastern partners think of all of this? So,
yeah. So two big questions. Let me start off with the first one. I think it's important for us to understand how the Israelis have defined their military doctrine and their strategy for their security. It is a rather unique one. Most countries define threats as a combination of intent times capability. So if you have countries around you that have the capability and are hostile in their attitude towards you, then you do perceive them as a threat. The Israelis do not define it in such a way. They assume that hostile intent is always present and is always there. So their focus is solely on capability. They simply, because of the Jewish experience, believe that they cannot allow any country or any combination of countries in the region to have the military might to be able to deter Israel or to be able to threaten Israel. Because it, the assumption is that if they have the capability, the intent automatically triggers that hostility. This is part of the reason why, under pressure of friends of Israel, pro-Israeli interests in the United States, laws have been passed in the United States that says that the United States has to maintain Israel's what is called strategic qualitative edge. We never sell weapons to countries in the Middle East that are on par with the weapons we sell Israel. It is because of this doctrine, which has then been encoded in American law, that we have to help ensure that Israel has that. The problem with this, of course, is that the number of countries that you may need to dominate as a result, because this is, in essence, military hegemony. Once you have this doctrine, you have to establish military hegemony, which is exactly what the Israelis have done in the West Bank and Gaza. It is what they have done in Syria and Lebanon. This is what they've indirectly have done with Egypt and Jordan, because these are countries that are so dependent on the United States that they cannot really cause much of a trouble for Israel, combined with the fact that, of course, the U.S. does not sell them any kind of weapons that is on par with what we sell the Israelis. But the problem is that as technology advances, the region becomes smaller. Countries that 40 years ago were outside of the realm of the world that Israel would potentially view as a threat are now inside of that realm. Iran is a prime example of that. Iran and Israel actually had very strong relations during the time of the Shah, extensive military and intelligence capability, collaboration. The Israelis actually lobbied the United States to sell more weapons to the Iranians, and even offered Iranians weapons that the US didn't sell Iran. That incidentally continued in the 1980s when Iran had its Islamic revolution and adopted a very anti-Israeli rhetoric and posture. But from the Israeli standpoint, they helped Iran get weapons from the United States. I'm sure you're familiar with the Iran-Contra scandal, and it's not the only example, but it was also because they were fearing that if Saddam won the war, they would face a much greater threat. So they had an interest in actually helping prop up Iran back in the 1980s. But back then, they were not worried if Iran had various kinds of missiles or airplanes or technology. In fact, Iran had the third most technically advanced military in the world because the Shah loved to buy American weapons because Iran was outside of that region in the sense that technology had not advanced. Now they're all so much closer to each other, which means that Israel increasingly needs to dominate a larger and larger area of geography. This is simply not sustainable. This is, at the end of the day, the reason why other countries don't have that military doctrine, because it will be your own death, because you will overextend and you will collapse. This is what empires do. But Israel is now stuck in a situation in which the blank check from the United States, in which we just give whatever it asks for, doesn't ask, we don't ask questions. We provided with all kinds of political and diplomatic cover at the UN internationally, and essentially defended and insulated from any consequences of its own actions. It has created a scenario in which Israel just goes further and further down a path that not only will bring it to a state of permanent pariahhood, but also a state in which it itself will not be able to sustain the empire, the hegemony that it has created, and it will collapse from inside, I think.
Talk to me about the neighbors, if you would, specifically Saudi. It seems
Yes.
like, again, Trump going to Saudi in June. It seems like things were getting better and de-escalating at that time, if you would. But what do the neighbors think of all of this, and how is it going to play out with all of them?
The neighbors are very, very upset. They already shifted around 2017, 2018, when the Iranians actually struck Saudi Arabia in 2019, after the Saudis had played a key role in helping the United States get Iranian oil off of the market through this maximum pressure strategy that Trump pursued under the guidance of John Bolton and Mike Pompeo. The Iranians tried to raise the cost for that policy. And one of the things that they did was to target tankers in the Persian Gulf, as well as Saudi oil fields. The Saudis expected that as a result of that attack, the United States would go to war with Iran on behalf of Saudi Arabia. Up until that point, the Saudis actually were on the same page as the Israelis and the Emiratis, wanting to see the United States go to war with Iran in order to cut it down in size. After it realized that actually, no, the United States won't go to war with Iran on behalf of the Saudis. And the Iranians actually have capabilities that will be tremendously damaging and dangerous for the Saudis and the Emiratis. You saw how both of these countries shifted.
Mm-hmm.
Realize that this was a rather dumb gamble. They're frontline states vis-a-vis Iran. They're going to fare very badly in any war that the United States wages on Iran. And that's when you saw that they shifted towards regional diplomacy and eventually led to the normalization between Iran and Saudi Arabia and shifting away from the Israeli strategy of wanting to see that type of a conflict because they will pay a very heavy price for it, whereas Israel is further away and will pay a price, but in a different way. So now, for the last couple of years, the Saudis, the Emiratis, all of the GCC states have actually favored a deal between the United States and Iran on the nuclear front. They were not happy with Israel's attack. They were not happy with the US's support for that attack. They want a more stable region. This is destabilizing the region. And you can also, of course, imagine how profoundly, profoundly upset they were over the fact that Israel then even attacked Qatar itself.
Mm-hmm.
Despite the fact that you have the largest US base there, the best air defense systems, and they did this attack. So now the Saudis and the Emiratis are not just worried about the US's approach towards the region that may be too military prone. They're also worried that the US's lack of constraints on Israel is not just enabling Israel to do whatever it wants in Gaza and the West Bank, not only allowing the Israelis to start wars with Iran, but even has gone so far so that if the Israelis want to bomb Qatar, the United States is essentially not standing in the way of that. And keep in mind, the US says that it was informed about it only 40 or so minutes before the attack. Various arguments, but bottom line is, what is the cost that was inflicted on Israel for having conducted an attack? We're not seeing much. I mean, we're seeing a couple of things. The US forced these Israelis to apologize to Qatar and pay compensation for the Qataris that were killed. We're seeing that the US moved towards some sort of a deal on the Gaza front to end the war, which now is in limbo, of course, again. That may have been, in fact, I do believe that those things came out of the fact that the Israelis overstepped their welcome, essentially, and created problems for the United States. It shifted the balance inside the White House, and then the US shifted a little bit. But that is still not saying that Israel actually pay the cost for having attacked a U.S. partner, a non-NATO ally of the United States.
Got it. Talk to me a little bit about the Russia and China involvement here, because it seems to be like this region, this regional war, this regional conflict is sucking in all of the major players, if you would. And I would say that's Russia and China. They're supportive of Iran. And it seems like we could possibly be going head to head again, another war, because we're already doing it with Ukraine, or have done it with Ukraine, with both Russia's first and then potentially China. Does that have that risk?
There is a bit of a risk, I would say, but I think we have to be somewhat clear. The Russians and the Chinese, or at least certainly the Chinese, have so far been far more clever than to allow themselves to get dragged into wars that do not benefit them, or to get dragged into the wars of countries that they are friends with. They don't have an alliance system in which they're overextending their obligations and have to go to war every 15 minutes because one of their partners ended up in some sort of a conflict. They've pursued the opposite strategy. They have pursued a strategy of trading with every country in the region, being on excellent terms with every country in the region without getting dragged into their conflict. So, for instance, China has excellent relations with Israel and with Iran and with Saudi Arabia, and it had so throughout this region, and managed to stay outside of their quarrels. I find that quite admirable, I have to say.
We have
done the exact opposite. We have ensured that we get dragged into every unnecessary, meaningless conflict in that region. And it's been to our detriment, and it's been to the detriment of the region as well. So I think the Iranians are quite disappointed. They were hoping certainly that the Russians would play a more helpful role to them during that war. I think their expectations on the Chinese are much, much more moderate because the Chinese have never signaled that they would have any such readiness. They have told the Iranians that they can provide them with air defense systems and weapon systems if they want to buy it. The Iranians appear to have declined those offers back in 22, 23 and are perhaps regretting it now, particularly since those systems appear to have performed very well for the Pakistanis in their short exchange of fire with India earlier this year. Whether the Iranians will have time now to buy a lot of different weapon systems from the Russians or the Chinese remains to be seen. As I mentioned earlier on, it is the Israelis have strong incentives of attacking again before that happens, before there even is any movement towards rebuilding Iran's air defense systems and other capabilities of deterrence. Iran's challenge is that its only deterrence right now is its offensive capability, not its defensive capabilities.
Okay, so about that, and we're going to make some assumptions here and play this out. And just for the record, I want no piece of any war, really. And I don't want any piece of this one. I am pro peace. I want peace. That being said, let's say things do escalate, and God forbid we do have a war with Iran. What does that look like? You just said something very key. I think it's offensive. Do you see Iran going full offensive on Israel and potentially the US on this? Like NATO bases is what I'm trying to get at.
I see Iran likely going very offensive against Israel. There is a strategy that the Iranians had pursued that they call strategic patience. They pursued it up until this year, essentially, which is that they took a lot of hits from Israel in Lebanon and particularly in Syria and did not respond because their calculation was that time is on their side. It is Israel that has a need for a war earlier rather than later. The problem with that strategy, of course, is that it enabled the Israelis to increasingly attack Iran and cross every so-called Iranian red line, and by that managed to destroy much of Iran's retaliatory capabilities inside of Syria. Of course, we saw what happened to Hezbollah. And as a result, there is no long game if you don't have a short game. So now things have switched. They recognize that the previous strategy was a failure, that Israel has advanced its positions far, far closer to Iran, and that at this point, they will have to strike back very hard in order to dispel, as I mentioned, the notion that they can be subjugated to Israeli military domination. So with them, yes. With the United States, the Iranians have done everything they can to avoid a direct military confrontation with the US. On the occasions that the US has attacked Iran or Iranian assets, the killing of Soleimani in 2021, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, sorry, 2020, to the attacks on Fordow, et cetera, we saw that the Iranians struck back, telegraphed it clearly, made sure that no Americans were killed, wanted to make a point, but certainly wanted to avoid a military confrontation. If, however, the United States fully signs on to the Israeli war plan, which is to get rid of the regime as a whole, or at least collapse the state, then at that point, I don't think the Iranians have any incentives not to strike back at the US as hard as possible because their backs will be completely against the wall. And this is, of course, what the Israelis are hoping for, that they get to a position in which not only the Iranians have no choice but to strike back, but it also leaves the US with no choice but to enter the war. And this is part of the reason I think the Trump administration and President Trump himself committed a huge mistake. He is saying that, look, I ended that war with that strike. In a tactical sense, he's actually right. He did something, and then he managed to put pressure on both sides for a ceasefire. But having green lighted this in the first place, he has put in motion the Israeli strategy in which he is increasingly trapped into what the Israelis decide. Even though tactically he did manage to end that war quickly, he put himself on a trajectory towards more wars in which the US will have less and less control unless he completely breaks and makes it very clear to the Israelis. You will not attack Iran. You will not drag us into war with Iran. And there is a very simple way for Trump to do so. If Trump says, I will not defend Israel, with our missile capability, anti-missile capabilities, and our defense systems, the Israelis simply cannot attack Iran because they need American defensive capabilities in order to protect themselves from the retaliatory fire. Without that American support, Israel air defenses will perform tremendously less than what they already did, and that will be too costly for the Israelis. So the US has tremendous amount of leverage. Trump has it. Biden had it. What we have not seen is American presidents being willing to consistently use that leverage for our own national interests. Trump has done it on a few occasions. He's not managed to sustain it. I didn't see Biden use it even once.
Yeah, well, let's pray that cooler heads prevail in all of this. And real quick, and I'll end on this. I am not to make for you to make a projection on the oil price or anything like that, but this would completely destabilize oil if this were to continue to escalate. I don't see Saudi pumping more oil to help us if any if this escalates. What's your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, in the scenario in which you have the Iranians completely having their backs against the wall and they start targeting US bases, I don't think they would target NATO bases, but US bases, then you will also likely see a scenario in which the Iranians may start to try to close down the Strait of Hormuz. And what we feared 20 years ago is that they would mine it and things of that nature. Today, they'll just copy what the Houthis have been doing in the Red Sea, which is that they shoot at ships and they don't even have to hit the ships. They can miss the ships.
Just the
But as
threat.
long as ships know that there is a risk of them being shot at, you will see traffic go down tremendously. And that will, of course, shoot up oil prices in a very, very dramatic way.
Yeah, again, I see no upside to this. Again, thinking strategically and obviously, and not discussing the humanitarian of it all. Trita, I am a new subscriber to your Substack. Please give that out,
Thank
and I'd
you.
love to put it in the show notes as well. And how do people get in touch with you if they want to learn more, as I have?
They can go to the website of my organization, which is Quincy Institute, which is quincyinst.org. They can go to my personal website, tritaparsi.com, or my Twitter, tparsi. And I think my Substack, which is relatively new, I think it is just Substack/tritaparsi.
I'll put all of this in the show notes. I want to thank you so much for your time, for
Thank you.
making
My
you're very
pleasure.
welcome. All right, I'd like to have you on again soon. Take care.
Anytime. Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.